This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Welcome to Cubs PS Plus, Northside Numbers Game, a weekly podcast that dives headfirst into the analysis of hot topics driving Chicago Cubs baseball. I'm your host, Mike Waller, lifelong Cub fan, full-time baseball stat nerd, and soon-to-be youth baseball coach. Cubs PS Plus is part of the Bleacher Bunch Productions on the Fans First Sports Network, joining great shows like The Sun Ranto Show, Cup of Cubby Blue, and Baseball Rabbit Hole. The Bleacher Bunch feed is available wherever you get your podcasts, and Cubs PS Plus is always available, ad-free, Patreon supporters at patreon.com/CubsPSPlus, where you can support the show and always find a variety of benefits for as little as a dollar a month. In addition to the podcast feeds, you can also find me on Twitter or X, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, Blue Sky, and YouTube, all at CubsPSPlus. Spin on the baseball metric, OPSPlus. Love the pod or hate it, please drop a review wherever it is you find your podcasts. If you've done that, thank you so much. Maybe you can share an episode with a friend. Welcome into episode 74, the Zach Short episode of this podcast. I wanted to toss a nod to former Cub draftee Zach, also a favorite co-host on the compound, for earning an opening day roster spot with the Mets. Zach is really wearing number 21 this season, but he's been wearing number 74 and wore it all through spring training, so I thought he'd be a good drop here. This week's episode is an interview I've been trying to line up lately around my surgery, and it's not particularly opening day related, but I'm joined by Matt Pirro, pitcher, former Wake Forest Demon Deacon and Washington Nationals farmhand, who joins me to talk about the changes over the last decade in technology related to pitching development. Are you ready? I'm ready. Here we go. So this week's episode is going to be a little bit of a mixed bag. I have an interview. We'll get to it here in a few minutes. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And also, this is a podcast I'm recording ahead of time. I have spring break plans with the family this next week, And hey, I'm out of my splint that I showed you guys the other day. I'm in a brace. I can move my arm a little bit. That's all good. I can get back to much more in terms of daily activities, but you guys don't need to hear about that. Let's hear about the Cubs. So last night was opening day. I'm recording this on Friday. I'll probably release the episode probably on Monday, and then I'll get back to hopefully recording something next weekend. I don't want to overreact, but today's topic, I've got Matt Pirro, a former pitcher with Wake Forest who was drafted and pitched in the Nationals organization, continues to coach young pitchers today, and he's going to talk about pitching development, some of the technology brought in there. But since it's an episode to talk about pitching, I'm going to talk a little bit about Justin Steele. So last night, Justin Steele looked really good. I mean, he was really sharp early. Before he got hurt, he threw 4 2/3 innings, gave up 3 hits and a walk, 6 strikeouts, gave up 1 run. I mean, he looked like basically mid-season form. I don't know how long they were going to let him go. He was at 67 pitches. So if he gets that, say he fields that bunt without pulling the hammy, gets another out, he's like a 70. Maybe he goes one more. They probably weren't going to push him far on opening day. But I've seen, obviously, you know, you lose your ace. That's definitely not a good thing. He's one of the, definitely one of the guys on this team that the Cubs can least afford to lose. I don't know that anybody in a 162-game season is, you know, completely irreplaceable depending on how long they're out. And we don't know on Steele yet. So this is Friday. It's early Friday afternoon. I have not seen any results yet from his MRI. I don't really expect to. I think with the MRI, you know, they're going to take the imaging. Everybody knows he has some sort of a hamstring strain. It looked like he was getting along reasonably okay last night. Craig Counsell said the injured list is likely. I certainly believe that because there's no reason for them to do anything with Justin Steele that's going to hinder his ability to be as healthy as possible over the course of 162. So I certainly assume he's going to miss 1 to 2 starts here. If you miss 2 starts, that's easily a 10-day IL stint. You might as well go on the IL, backfill the roster, so you have a full roster going forward. And we'll see. I'm hopeful he'll miss, 1 to 3 starts. Even 4 would not be catastrophic. Start getting much more than that. And the Cubs rotation does have questions. But one of the things I keep seeing is, I think heading into the season, I think you either love the Cubs rotation or you were really uncomfortable about it. I was pretty optimistic about it. So let's walk into about the start of the fourth inning yesterday. Justin Steele's healthy. He's looking good. We know Tyone's on the shelf for a couple more weeks. We'll see. He's got a long track record of being a solid pitcher. I like what I've seen from Kyle Hendricks coming back from that injury last year. I'm fairly optimistic. He's not going to win Cy Young. I said in the preview episode, this isn't vintage 2016 Kyle Hendricks, but I think he's a guy who can still get outs. Jordan Wicks has looked really good this spring. He looked really good at the end of last season when he came up. I think he's on this show and other places. You've heard people talk about him. Greg Huss just talks about him like he's an absolute bulldog, and I absolutely believe it. He was unfazed last year when he gave up that leadoff home run, and then I think he walked or hit a guy, something like that. And then he was just nails for the rest of his outing. He battles through. If he doesn't have his staff, his full stuff, he will still give you a good, strong outing. And then you go to Javier Assad. He's a guy I've talked about a lot on the show. He's from a numbers, from an analytics, from a Statcast and raw data perspective. And in fact, Matt and I talk about Javier Assad a little bit, or pitchers like him. His stuff doesn't blow you away. And when you look at the underlying metrics, the Statcast data, he's a guy, he doesn't get chase. He doesn't get whiff. That means guys are reading his pitches. He's not getting them to chase out of the zone. And they don't swing and miss a lot. Now, the swinging out of the zone, the chase, Javi throws a lot of strikes. So he fills the zone up. He's not a pitcher that relies on chase, but he also doesn't get it. On the flip side, on the negative side, he does give up a pretty high barrel rate, which means that when they see him, when they hit him hard, it's often barreled up. And barrel rate is something very specific. So that is, I forget the exact equation, but it's 95 miles an hour exit velo plus a 20 to 35 degree exit or launch angle. I mean, it's a combo of exit velo and launch angle. I forget the exact math right off the top of my head right now, but he gives up a pretty high barrel rate. But when you look over the court, across all of his pitching, he gives up a really low, league-wide low, not the lowest in the league, but one of the better ones in the league, consistent average exit velo. He gives up a low average exit velocity, which means consistently, while guys will barrel him up sometimes, guys are not consistently hitting him hard. He has a really high ground ball rate, gets a lot of guys to beat things into the ground, which is great with this infield and the defense the Cubs have. So I'm pretty optimistic about him. And this is going to be a year, I think, that tells us a lot about who Javi Assad is. He looked really good at the end of 2022 when he came up. He's a guy that, Greg Huss has come on the show and talked about. He was looking like he was maybe not going anywhere. And then he changed his pitch mix a little bit, developed a slider, and that kind of set him up. Now he's got pitches that play differently. And I think there's a chance that Javier Assad is an actual outlier. His fastball plays in a unique way. It's not a true unicorn pitch like Justin Steele's cut-right fastball is. But there are things to like about his stuff that give reason to think that he could really be an outlier. So with that's the rotation of 5 right now. So Steele goes down, and you look at depth. Drew Smyly is on the team right now. He's kind of the guy who you would look to for the long guy. He's a guy who, if they were to decide Justin Steele's injury was pretty minor, going to miss one start, maybe doesn't need an IL stint, then Drew Smyly is maybe that guy that would step up and take, you know, Steele's next turn through the rotation to get him back and down. But I think at this point, they're going to be super cautious with Steele. I'm sure he'll miss at least two. So I don't know that they necessarily plug Smyly into the starting rotation. They could. And if they put him into the starting rotation, then for the bullpen, you're looking to Iowa, you're probably bringing up, could potentially bring up Daniel Palencia, but maybe they bring up Hayden Wesneski to come up and be a long guy. But if it's not Drew Smyly, then I think the next two guys who were in line would be Hayden Wesneski and Ben Brown. Wesneski did not look good in spring training. Make no bones about that. But I think Craig Counsell likes him. And the raw stuff that we all saw when he came over from New York, when he came up in late in the 2022 season, when he threw that immaculate inning, that stuff is all still there. His issue is kind of like Adbert's, and we saw that last night, getting lefties out sometimes is a problem. And that's more of a problem when you're a starting pitcher and you're going through a longer lineup, you're going through it potentially 2 to 3 times. It's something he's got to continue to work on. But I think there's, you know, Craig Counsell talked about it at Cubs convention. He's talked about it during spring training. We saw them send Wesneski down to stay stretched out as a starter. I think he's a guy that they clearly have not given up on yet as a starting pitcher. The next guy is Ben Brown, who looked absolutely electric this spring training. And he's a guy who at some point this year is going to get a shot. I think he would have gotten a shot late last year, maybe instead of Wicks, except that Brown got hurt towards the end of last year and then it took a while to come back and he struggled a little bit after he came back. But I would look to probably see either Wesneski or Ben Brown come up. Now, by the time you hear this, it'll be Monday. They may have already made other decisions. I'm not like an absolute moron. But that's what I'm thinking at this point. But one of the key things I think that's important to remember with where the Cubs are right now, I know I've talked on this show. I wanted them to go get Yoshinobu Yamamoto. I was certainly no worse than interested in the Cubs going to get Jordan Montgomery. Now, the longer Jordan Montgomery sat, I thought it was less and less likely the Cubs were going to go do it. And now he's signed with Arizona, so totally off the table. But I think Jed Hoyer this offseason is showing that he did make additions. You know, they brought Cody Bellinger back. They signed Shota Imanaga to fill a rotation spot. And then after and beyond that, I really genuinely think that Jed likes the organization and the farm system they have. And one of the careful balances when you have a top farm system is trying to find that key moment when you start going to the kids. Because it's one thing to be a top two, top three, top four, wherever you think this farm system ranks. I think Baltimore's clearly number one, and then a lot of places have the Cubs two, maybe three. Wherever you think they rank, there are certainly prospects who are not ready yet. You know, we're not going to see Jefferson Rojas for a couple more years. Pitchers we won't see for a while, but there's a lot of talent now that's very close to the major leagues. You know, we saw in spring training, Kevin Alcantara had good games. Owen Casey crushed the ball. Alexander Canario is very close. You know, Ben Brown, Hayden Wesneski are right there. Cade Horton is coming. I think Cade Horton is, I have not seen the specific plan for him, but I've not seen him yet get assigned to a triple or a minor league affiliate. So I still think the Cubs are going to start him slow, probably keep him in Arizona a little bit longer for a few more weeks, get him started maybe in Double A in May, late April, early May, just to delay that start. We've talked about it. He threw 53 innings his last year in college after all the arm trouble. He threw 87 and two-thirds last year. So, you know, you kind of increase those, you know, increase how much you throw as you're trying to stretch a kid out by maybe 40, 50% per year. So if he's pushing 90, you know, you add another 40 to 45 innings to that, you're really in that 120, 130 range. And I think what the Cubs don't want to do is get into a situation like the Nationals got into back in, 2012, 2013 with Steven Strasburg when he came up and they brought him up probably too early in the season. He was absolutely electric. They were worried about injuries. And they were in a pennant race, and they shut him down. And I think the Cubs are going to try to work this out so that whenever it is that Cade starts, assuming he stays healthy and effective, that he's going to go and pitch through the end of the season, whether that's the whole year in the minors, whether that's coming up to the bigs and finishing in Chicago. So I think he's coming, but not yet. And so the Cubs are betting on that organizational depth. Now, the Cubs also have the prospect capital, clearly as the, you know, number two, number three farm system in baseball, to go make a trade and get a guy. And so that's something that the Cubs can do anytime between now and the trade deadline to help this team out. And we'll see, the first thing to watch is how long Justin Steele's out. If it turns out that Justin Steele's injury is worse than I'm reading it to be, and he's going to be out, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months, a 60-day IL stint, something like that, then that's a much bigger deal. And then I think they probably start looking at some of the kids quickly, trying to get an assessment of where those guys are right now. And then the Cubs might have to look to go make a move. Otherwise, you know, you ride this out. You know, if Steele misses 3 weeks, 4 starts, you know, you go through it, you fill in with whatever it is you think. But at some point, there's a line that has to be crossed where prospects become, you either trade them for major league pieces or you find out if they're going to become dudes. And now with Brown, certainly with Wesneski, probably soon with Cade Horton, it's going to be time to start finding out. And finding out, every time you get new info, you get smarter, you get in a better position. So if the Cubs find out that Ben Brown isn't ready, it doesn't mean, like, Ben Brown's still pretty young. I think he's 24, maybe 25 this year. Even if he comes up and struggles and is not ready right now, that doesn't mean he's a bust. It's never going to pan out. It just may mean he's not ready right now. But that starts to tell you what you have to do for the rest of the season. And so we'll see where that goes. But I think the Cubs have done a lot with their pitching infrastructure. Matt and I are going to talk about kind of what goes into that, some of the tools behind the scenes, what those are used for. You know, he'll talk about his experience. You know, he was at Wake Forest when the technology started to emerge. Wake Forest has long been a school at the tip of the spear on, you know, pitching development technology. And so it's an interesting position because he started at a time when some of that stuff wasn't there. It really blew up after he left. He stayed connected. Now he's stayed connected in baseball circles, and he's seeing a lot of different teams doing a lot of different things. But talking through kind of it gives an idea what the Cubs have built, what they're relying on. And if the Cubs trust their infrastructure, the Cubs should be able to produce some arms to come up and help show depth and help fill this. And if not, maybe we'll find out they really didn't do enough this offseason. Maybe we'll find out the depth of the system is not as good as maybe it's advertised right now. But I think right now, Jed Hoyer is placing a bet squarely on the organization of the farm system. And we'll see how that pans out. I'm going to turn it over to my interview with Matt. Hope you guys have a great week while I'm away. Hopefully the Cubs, when I come back, hopefully the Cubs are, like 6-1, 7-1, something like that. But I'm just looking to, as I said the other day, I'm looking to get through this April, roughly 500. The Cubs have a tough schedule to start. It does stay tough for the first half is a lot tougher, I think, than the second half, at least on paper right now. So get off to a decent start. Don't lose the division now. But I'm going to turn it over to the interview.
This week, I'm thrilled to be joined by Matt Pirro, former pro pitcher in the Washington Nationals organization and star at Wake Forest. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah. So we're going to talk pitching today. We'll get into a lot of nuts and bolts. And you came through, give me a little of your background, but you came through Wake Forest at a time when they were starting to put in what would be considered like today's modern pitching infrastructure. Kind of talk me through that.
Yeah, so came in at a really interesting time, was truly there right as the pitching lab was being built. Didn't get to use it myself, but started to get to use a little bit of the technology that was going to eventually be in there.
And what's your background as a player? So you came up, you were at Wake in the early 2010s?
Yep, I was a freshman in 2011 and then graduated and got drafted by the Nationals in 2015.
And what was the difference between like life in college and then the pros? Because now I've heard the Nationals are not exactly the most proactive development organization, but was there a big difference between what you saw at Wake and what you saw with the Nationals?
Yeah, a dramatic difference. And I think the biggest thing, right, is when you go from a Power 5 school and into professional baseball, it's a little bit of a culture shock, right? You go from beautiful facilities and having everything that you need to, you know, some older buildings and older facilities and older programs, frankly. So it was definitely a little bit of a shift in culture shock. But at the end of the day, right, it's still baseball. It's still out there competing. And, you know, I think the biggest difference, right, is the guys just get that much better at that level.
So what was in place at Wake when you started? So that was kind of before all the pitch development. Like, what's the kind of the old school way that you saw coming through?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, my wife actually mentioned the other day, we're coming up on our 10-year reunion, which is crazy to even think about. But you think back to it, you know, we were doing a lot of our video review on cell phones, right? Coach taking a video of you. We had some of those, you know, old, I forget what they call them, but they're the white cameras that you see around stadiums that mm-hmm. were getting the different angles of pitching, but you know, not a whole lot from a technology perspective, right? You're just pulling up the video of each pitch. You know, it's categorized and documented with a velocity, and you can see it from every angle. And we kind of slow it through and go frame by frame. That evolved over my time at Wake. By the end of it, right, we had, you know, a full-blown TrackMan system, you know, on all sides of the field. But I never got into the full, you know, biomechanics side of things or the edrochronic camera side of things. TrackMan was really that first, you know, toe in the water for us, and was there for part of that.
And now, I mean, TrackMan's everywhere, and they've got the Hawkeye system and everything else. Like, what do you think? I know you work with a lot of young pitchers now. What do you think is the biggest change in terms of, like, how would you have applied it to yourself going back 10 years?
Yeah, I think it truly comes down to the ability to make quick changes, right? You know, you think of what is available to players today and what's available to coaches today. You can look frame by frame and pitch by pitch with edrochronic cameras, and then you can also go in and compare it to somebody that might be a like thrower. Those things, right, you were doing visually back when I was playing. So you'd see somebody on TV that you might look or move like and try to implement the things mm-hmm. that they were doing. Now you can do that in real time. So it's just the ability to make changes quickly versus, you know, years ago it would take, you know, a full year to make some changes at times, where now you're seeing it happen in a bullpen session.
And how fast is that in terms of, like, you've got a new pitcher, you're working with a guy, you think he looks like somebody else, you want to add a new pitch. Like, how good are those matches? Like, how deep is that data that teams have access to that?
I from what I've seen, it's pretty extensive. And it's pretty cool to see. I think the biggest thing is it gives you a variety of options, right? Just because one profile might look the exact same doesn't mean that's actually going to work for the guy that you're working with. But the ability to go to, you know, multiple plots all in that same vicinity or all in that same profile mm-hmm. and pull the data from those players and see if one of the things that they're doing really well works for the guy that you're working with, I think is just a massive difference.
And what kind of comps would pitching coaches use for that? Is it kind of velo matching arm, you know, dominant arm, or is it a lot of mechanics, release point? Like, what do they look at?
Yeah, I think the one I hear most common is pitch profiles, right? So if you got a guy with a rising fastball, right, you're going to go ahead and try to grab those guys that also throw rising fastballs. And if you're struggling with your guy to get them to throw a tight slider, you can pull those guys, see what ones throw a really good slider, and try to play off of that. So I think a lot of times it comes off of pitch profiles, but also body movement's a big thing too, right? How a guy moves down the mound, how it moves throughout his delivery. I think those are probably the two most common paths.
Okay. Back in your day, you were a power pitcher, right? Like, you were throwing mid-upper 90s?
The year I got drafted, yeah. Yep, that's where I sat. I was anywhere from 92 to 95 that year. Prior to that, pitched in more of the 88 to 91 range.
Back when not everybody threw 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, back when you pulled out the scouting report, and 88 to 91 was on the higher end of things. Now you're rolling out rosters and scouting reports of 9, 10, 11, 12 guys, 95 or better. So yeah, it's changed quickly in 10 years.
That's crazy. Now you were, I know we've talked about this in the past, but you were primarily fastball, curveball, and then went to more slider your last year, or do I have that backwards?
No, that's right. I was a fastball breaking ball mix my whole life. You know, grew up in upstate New York and in Syracuse, and you know, baseball up there, right, isn't the best. You know, you're not playing year round, so when you're throwing, you know, into the low 90s in high school, you're going to get away with two pitches. And even at Wake, to some degree, I got away with that as well. You know, if you pulled my splits from back in the day, I really struggled right on left, probably because I lacked a changeup. And so, you know, my 4 years, for the most part, were built around developing a changeup. That year where my velocity spiked and started to throw a little bit harder, the breaking ball got bigger, and so it was harder to control. And so actually had a scout, you know, through my process that year that had asked, like, hey, have you ever tried tinkering with a cutter or slider? You know, would love to see what that would look like and if you could keep that in the zone more. And so we started throwing that probably midway through my draft year, and then carried that into pro ball.
So that's a good topic. So the Cubs have had a number of guys over the last couple of years that are that classic, like righty struggles to get lefties out. And, you know, Edward Alzolay was one who struggled with it, but he's kind of figured it out with another pitch. Hayden Wesneski is one the Cubs picked up from the Yankees. He's going through the same struggles. Like, if you can't get that change up, and a good change is hard to throw, what kind of pitches would a right-hander look at to go at those lefties?
Yeah, I think it's hitter dependent, right? I think that's where you really have to lean into what a hitter does well and what you do well. The pitching coach I had the year I got drafted, Matt Hobbs, who's now the pitching coach at Arkansas, you know, his whole philosophy was, you know, we're going to do what you do really well, and we're not going to worry about what the hitter does, right? So it's almost leaning into more of those outlying pitches that you may already have versus like, hey, you need to add a third pitch or a fourth pitch to be able to get this type of guy out. But I think it's really leaning into what you already do and either sharpening it a little bit more or just trusting that that's what's going to win for you.
Okay. Now, some of the pitchers, I think we've seen classically starting pitchers, you know, need to have, what, 4 or 5 pitches. Yu Darvish famously has about 47 different pitches he throws. But there are some pitchers who seem to get by on just a couple pitches. And Justin Steele's an example for the Cubs. He's got kind of that bullet spin fastball. What is it about those kind of unique pitches, kind of those unicorns or those real outliers that really allow a guy to get by with maybe 1 or 2 pitches or maybe occasionally use a third?
Yeah, I think the answer is kind of in what you just said, right? They're truly outliers. It's not an everyday, it's not a book pitch, right? Like it's something that a hitter is not seeing day to day or arm to arm. And so, like, you know, you watch a college baseball game today or a major league baseball game today, and yeah, you see the average velocity has shot right up. I think the year I got drafted, it was like 89.7, and I think last year was in the upper 93s to maybe low 94s, if I remember correctly. Well, you know, hitting really hasn't changed a whole lot other than launch angle and what guys are trying to do offensively, and there's a lot more swing and miss, but that's more, you know, I think swing dependent. I think it's just really comes down to, you know, what they see every single day and being able to adjust to that. And that's why those guys that have those unique pitches, right? Tampa's famously done this with guys. They find outlier pitches and make those guys into really valuable pieces. And I think it just comes from a usage perspective, right? Really leaning into that. And teams now have that data to be able to say, hey, so-and-so, you know, you're getting an 80% whiff percentage on this pitch, but you're only throwing at 25%. We need to flip that, right? That pitch needs to be thrown 60% of the time. So I think that's a big component of it too.
So in terms of the pitch usage, I think a lot of guys are still kind of fastball heavy, but what goes into the balance between, you know, using a curve versus slider, how often to mix the changeup in there? Is that really unique per pitcher, or are there some kind of schools of thought there?
Yeah, I think there historically has been schools of thought, right? Like, you know, you don't want to follow certain pitches with other pitches, and, you know, you want to lean into what you do really well, but, you know, a hitter might, you know, like something in a certain count, right? I think that's flipped a lot, and I think that's where the analytics of the game have really taken off, and you're seeing the percentages of swings, you're seeing the percentages of whiffs, you're seeing all of that compiled together to really dictate what pitch is being thrown and what count and where and why. To the point where, you know, if you talk to a hitter today, right, they're looking at one specific spot of the zone for one pitch, right? And if they get that in the at-bat, great, they're going to do damage on it. But if they don't, the stuff has gotten so good that they're really not going to be able to fall back into that. But I think it comes back to the analytic portion of things of just, hey, we can see by the data that this pitch is getting X amount of whiffs every time it's thrown. You need to throw that more versus maybe the old school thought of, hey, you need to be a 3-pitch guy or 4-pitch guy and have a mix.
Well, let's back up a little bit. So talk about the pitching lab. And I know you're still pretty connected to Wake Forest. You kind of have an idea what's in their system. And I think baseball's a copycat game, right? As soon as something's working for somebody, that they're all buying the same stuff. So walk me through what's in a pitch lab. Like, what kind of equipment do they set up and how do they use the different components?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how much I can share or am willing to share,
Look,
but I know
be general,
without
don't
getting
be way
myself into
specific, but I know you're I know you're tied in with how they work.
Yeah, no, I think the biggest thing is, and you see it, right? You're spot on. It's a copycat game. I think, you know, Wake loves to throw out the statistic that, you know, 30 major league teams have been by to visit the facility annually and take a look at what we're doing in the pitching lab. I think there's a mix of analytical tools like the TrackMans and Rapsodos that we see constantly. There's now a ton more on the biomechanics side. So you're seeing a lot of force plates within the mounds. You're seeing a lot of, you know, true biomechanic cameras. And then you're going to see the Eggertronic cameras, which are going to be the frame by frame, really high def images as well.
I had Mike Son, who's the head baseball scientist for the Cubs, on last year, and he was talking through. He came from a company that did a lot of those biomarkers, where you could do like, you could actually do the biomechanic breakdown without even having the sensors on the person. Mm-hmm. But like, that stuff's amazing. But talk about the force plates. So when I assume the force plates are at both the rubber and the land point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is that that's measuring force forward and the way they land, and I imagine helps capture the body position.
It does, yeah. And I think, right, that's something that you haven't historically seen, and it's now even making its way into game mounds from what I understand. But just being able to measure that force at impact that's being placed on the shoulder, the elbow, other parts of the body, you know, from an injury prevention standpoint, huge, but also from a delivery building standpoint, also huge, right? You're able to take a guy and really just work around that, right? If at foot strike and at ball release, there's a ton of stress on the elbow and you can see that, you're able to go in and make some mechanical adjustments to maybe alleviate some of that stress or that pain and help that guy stay on the field.
I imagine that helps with consistency too. Like a guy just, I assume you build a profile for what a guy typically does, what he typically looks like. And if things get a little wonky or he's losing his command, like you can go back and look, or he's feeling some pain, go back and look through and see maybe what's changed.
Yeah, I think it's like anything, right? You start to build a little bit of a historical deck, right, and a historical backlog. And so, you know, if a guy is doing one thing really well in 2022 and in 2024 he's really struggling to repeat what he did, you can now go back and look at how he was moving at that time and try to build things to get him to move back, like move like he was back in 2022. So I think it's, you know, it's great for player development. It's great for the game. I wish I had all of these things when I was still playing. Hopefully that would have prevented me from ending up on the shelf and being in software sales today. So no, it's cool to see all the things that these guys have access to and are able to do on a daily basis.
Let's talk about the Edgetronic cameras. I know everybody has those. Like, what does that give you? What does that look like? Allow you to do?
Yeah, it's real depth imaging that at ball release, which I think, you know, you're physically seeing how the ball is exiting the hand, and you're able to then compare it to other guys and how the ball is coming out of their hand. And that's where you really see, I think, the true changes of pitch development. I think that's, you know, from my experience and what I've seen and the conversations I've had, it's really more tailored to pitch design. But that's something, right? Like 10 years ago when, you know, we were talking about my example of, you know, learning how to throw a slider midseason, I remember grabbing Parker Dunshee, who was the all-time strikeout leader at Wake, who had a great slider, and saying, hey, Park, let's start throwing together. Like, I need to figure out how you're throwing this. And so it took weeks of playing catch to just see how he was moving and how he was throwing it and how he was gripping it and then applying it to myself and doing that. Whereas now with these Eggertronic cameras, you can do that in real time in a bullpen session and a true pitch design session.
And that'll show to detail like how you're gripping the ball, hand alignment with the ball, how the ball is coming off the hand, whether you're getting it off the correct finger in the right timing, all that type of thing.
Yep, all of it.
That's amazing.
It's not fair.
Does the Edgetronic camera capture much in the way of spin? Probably right out of the hand, and that's...
Yeah, and spin to home plate, right? You can follow it all, the ball, how the ball's revolutions are moving to home plate, which I think they use. I don't have a ton of exposure to that personally, but I think that all kind of ties into that pitch design world and pitch design sessions that we see today.
And do you know, what are the big improvements on Hawkeye over the old TrackMan system? Have you worked much with that?
Haven't seen it personally. I've seen some videos. Wake is using Kinetrax. Okay. I know they've been pretty vocal about that this year and implementing that into what they're doing. I think the biggest thing when it comes to that, just like, you know, Rapsodo and TrackMan and all the other analytical tools that got implemented in the game years ago, you know, there's that period of time where, you know, we have that data, but we don't necessarily know how to use it or how to coach to it or how to develop around it. I think, you know, there are some really true practitioners now of that, that we didn't necessarily see at the front end of that. I think now biomechanics is going to be the next wave of that, right? We're seeing all of these new platforms like Hawkeye, like Kinetrax, get implemented into stadiums and into teams programs. And, you know, I think we're going to start to see over the next 3 to 5 years that biomechanic piece really become a true part of development. Not that it isn't today, but I think we're going to see true practitioners of that, just like we do with the analytical piece now.
Well, and that feeds into not only the performance, but also it's got to backfeed into the training, right? Like you can see where a guy doesn't have enough strength, needs more rotation, needs more drive off the legs, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely. It kind of feeds the whole algorithm, right? As an athlete and as a player, right? It kind of gives a North Star of where to run to versus a guessing game.
So how do you think some of this new stuff would have changed your game back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have made a world of difference for me personally. I think, you know, I tore my labrum and rotator cuff in spring training of 2016. I would love to think that a lot of this would have prevented it, you know, whether, you know, with shoulders, right? You know, you don't necessarily know exactly when it tears, right? A lot of guys have fraying, right? If you grabbed a thrower's shoulder and took an MRI of it, you're going to see a tear. It's just the variation of how bad the tear is and what the discomfort level is. So I would love to think that, you know, having some of this stuff, you know, earlier in my career would have helped prevent some of that. My guess is from a force perspective, I was probably applying too much or too little or had too much stress on my shoulder at certain points in my delivery that may have been able to have been changed quicker.
It's funny, when you and I were growing up, I'm older than you are, but still we're kind of pre everybody having Tommy John surgery all the time. Shoulder injuries used to be the biggest fear. Now it seems way more elbow. Like, is that more just the velocity and the force?
Yeah, I think Tommy John, you know, surgeries have continually become more prevalent in with how hard guys are throwing today, with how much force they're applying to a baseball, with how much they're spinning a baseball today. I don't know that that number's ever going to decrease. I think shoulders, right, with technology, I think that's been aided a lot more. But in the same breath, right, guys come back from Tommy John, whereas you still don't really see guys making true recoveries from massive shoulder surgeries or injuries. Those guys don't usually come back the same for whatever reason.
It's true. Excuse me. So when you look around the game today, like what do you think are some of the best pitches in baseball? Which guys do you look to that have just the stuff you can't wait to watch?
I wouldn't say that I have anybody that really is a true, like, I got to watch this guy throw today. I mean, I'm a born and raised Yankee fan, so I don't miss many Garrett Cole starts. You know, love myself some Marcus Stroman, which I know I've told you before. But for me, it's really more so about guys that just love competing and love being out there and guys that I can go then point to the kids that I coach and say, hey, like, these are people that you should be watching. These are guys that are out there getting after it. They want to be there. They want to compete, and you can see it and feel it. Those are more the guys I lean to stuff-wise, right? Like the game today, you know, 95% of the guys that get rolled out there, you're like, oh my God, like, what was that? I was just watching a video of Jordan Hicks like last spring training outing, and I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, guy's going to go win the Cy Young this year. So to me, it's not so much about stuff. It's more so about competition and the true competitors out there. You know, love me some Max Scherzer from back in the Nationals days too.
Oh, yeah. That dude, talk about difference between pitch day and not pitch day.
Oh, my goodness. The backfield stories I have of watching him pitch to the minor league teams. Truly my first ever moment of like, yeah, I probably don't belong here was watching him throw on a backfield in spring training.
Just because he was that good.
Yeah, just the, you know, how dialed into the game he was, you know, his stuff, right? I don't even think he was throwing fastballs that day. I think it was all cutters and sliders and a couple two seams here and there. But just the fire that he had, how he was attacking guys, and just the ability to basically be out there telling you what was coming, and the guys still have no chance. It just first, it was the first reality of like, this is truly a completely different level.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I was going to ask you about too. So spring training, like you watch a guy go out and the starter might get lit up or walk a bunch of guys, but spring training, you really don't know what a guy's doing. He might be out there just trying to work two or three off pitches or not throw fastball or just throw fastball. It seems like that's pretty common. Is that from your experience? Is that very common?
Oh yeah. Very much the case, right? Those, the results in a spring training game, right? Like obviously you'd love them to be great. You'd love to have success in them. I think it's more important for the younger guys, right? Or the guys on the bubble, like somebody like myself, mm-hmm. right? If I'm going out there trying to feel out and get over 2-0, 2-1, you know, negative pitching count, change ups or breaking balls for strikes, and I'm getting teed off on, probably not going to look good for the 21st rounder that was a senior sign. But for the first, second, third rounder that has some money invested in them or the big leaguer that's getting ready for the season, those guys are working on very specific things and not necessarily trying to get an outcome. They're trying to actually work on development in those moments because, you know, I think we all joke about how long the baseball season is and spring training feeds into that, but spring training is pretty quick, right? It's a pretty quick ramp into the season.
Yeah.
And I think season starts what, Thursday?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's right here and it feels like pitchers and catchers just reported, you know, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, even spring training feels long this year, but I'm just anxious for it all to get started.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you watch a lot of college ball, I know.
Yeah.
Who's popping for you this year?
I mean, I think Arkansas is at the top of that list. I think it's hard to argue what Hayden Smith has done and what Coach Hobbs has done with that pitching staff. I feel like every guy that I see throw for them is throwing in the mid to upper 90s. I know it's not everybody, but I feel like every time I turn that game on, that's what I see. They just seem like the most complete team today. And I think there's some other teams like LSU and Wake Forest that are, you know, a little coming off an Omaha hangover and trying to find their identities a little bit. Both teams got ridden by the draft last year and have young guys playing and guys coming out of the portal playing. So those are two teams, right, that I watch a lot of. Was fortunate enough to go out to Omaha to see them in person last year. I think otherwise, you look at Florida, right, with Caglione doing what he's doing both on both sides of the ball. They're a hard to miss game for me.
That's crazy.
And, you know, I think Clemson, right, it's not come out of nowhere, right? I think everybody knew how good Clemson was. I don't think we thought they would be, you know, a top five team good this early on. But they've been extremely impressive to watch. They just had a big series win over Florida State with game two and game three had major deficits. I think game two, they were down 7 or 8 in the ninth inning and found a way to win. So there's some really good baseball being played now. And I think there's some really good teams that aren't playing well yet that are going to be as they continue to get healthy and the season goes on. So it should be a fun finish to the college baseball season.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, Hagen Smith has been amazing this year. I'm going to talk through and compare Hagen Smith. You and I have talked about Brody Breck, so I'm an Iowa homer, and he's a dude with amazing stuff that it's just not coming together yet this year. And there's so many guys like that in the minor leagues, guys that have electric stuff. You can get by A ball, sometimes even into Double A, just on pure gas or just filth. But eventually, like if you can't locate the fastball, and I think that's Brody's problem, but like, what do you see as the difference between someone who's a lot more polished like Hagen Smith and Brody Brecht? Like, what if you were a coach, and how would you get that kid to try to get just more consistency?
Yeah, I mean, in Brody's scenario, he really hasn't been a pitcher that long, right? Where Hagen's probably been throwing his entire life and, you know, has had a much different trajectory, right? If you look at the two of them side by side, just at the college level, you know, what was it, a year ago, Brody was still spending half his time playing football, right?
That's
true. You know, so I think for him specifically, it's time, right? Time on the mound, time on the field, right? Time training as a baseball player. I think that's a big thing. But I also think he's had this meteoric rise, right? Of like, who's this guy touching, you know, into the low 100s and him becoming a full-time baseball player. I think that's tough to do. And then the expectations build. So part of it's, right, just allowing him to step back and try to find his true identity. It seems like he's done that at times. I've caught a couple of his starts just to have some dialogue with you about it. And it seems like to me the starts that he leans into the secondary stuff and isn't so fastball dominant, he's been a little bit better and a little bit more consistent. But I think really it's just for him, it's gaining that confidence to trust his stuff enough to get in the zone more. And from a movement perspective. I'm sure there's some stuff going on there. Obviously, we don't have access to that data and what that looks like, but I'm sure there's something going on the back end that they're trying to make some adjustments to help him, you know, deliver a more repeatable delivery.
It just seems like there are so many guys like that. You get to guys who get to AAA and maybe flash at the big leagues. The Cubs had Dylan Maples for a few years who was absolutely ridiculous stuff, but just couldn't keep it in the zone enough to even get hitters to chase. That's got to be such a routine problem for pitching coaches to deal with at those levels.
It definitely is. And I think a lot of times that stuff snowballs, right? Like, not that I was Brody Breck or anywhere close to that, but you know, if you look back to my last year, the year I got drafted, I walked a ton of guys, like probably historically bad walk rates. And I think a part of that, right, was it starts to snowball on you. You know, all of a sudden you walk a couple guys in a game and you're like, oh man, I've been walking five or six every outing. And next thing you know, you're back at five or six. And scouting reports get out there and people understand that and know that and know that you're not in the zone a ton. So, you know, swing rates lessen, right? Whether you're making good pitches or bad pitches, it feels like. So a lot of times, you know, some of that stuff can just happen from a change of scenario, right? Like, he might get the pro ball and automatically get a little bit of an uplift, right? I'm sure whatever team selects him is going to have some tweaks for him. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine just the clean slate's also probably going to help him too. So a lot of time I feel like delivery and repeatability of a delivery is key to throwing strikes. I think a lot of it's mental too, right? Like, just getting the guy to believe in his stuff and believe in what he's doing and, you know, have conviction around what he's doing, I think are the big things for those guys in those cases.
Yeah. I guess I want to flip the opposite now. So we've got those guys that have just amazing stuff, electric stuff. There are also guys that don't have stuff that's really all that special, but still somehow manage to get outs. And I know for a long time people would point to like Kyle Hendricks as that kind of example, but I think he has a pretty elite changeup and he's shown over the course of time that he's going to locate his pitches. You know, as a Cub fan now, I look at like a guy like Javier Assad. If you look at his Statcast metrics, he does give up a pretty high barrel rate, but he doesn't get much chase or much whiff. But also overall, he very consistent over the course of like a season and a half, consistent weak contact. Like, is that particularly coachable, or is that just a guy who has a knack for throwing it where he needs to throw it?
Yeah, I think some guys are just like that, right? Like, for one reason or another, they just get outs. I think that's a tale as old as time, right? I think you can point to those guys in baseball throughout history that you're not really sure what they're doing or how they're doing it, but they're getting outs every single inning. And you know, it may not look the prettiest. It may not look the flashiest. It may not be the most fun to watch, but they're in the dugout after 20 pitches, regardless of what the inning looks like. So I don't know that it's anything coachable. I think some guys are just have unique profiles that aren't, you know, below average or above average. There's kind of in the middle somewhere, and they kind of play into what they do really, really well. And they do that at a very high level, right? I know, like you said, Kyle Hendricks is usually the example that people point to, and it's come to light over time that he has some pretty, pretty big outliers in what he does day to day. But I think, you know, he still remains a great example, right, of just pure stuff, competing in the zone at all times, day after day, start after start. I think that stuff starts to compound, and you know, you start to build confidence behind what you're doing and how you're moving and how you're throwing. And to me, a part of it's a competition piece, right? Like, that true belief, that true competitor. You know, are you going to go out there and get outs or not? Find a way somehow, some way, right? Yeah. We used to talk about attacking hitters and four pitches or less. Those guys are often the guys that embrace that fully.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not chasing the strikeout. You just want to get a ball in play, get that ground ball, and get out. And yeah, we saw with Kyle Hendricks when he had that shoulder injury, missed almost a full season. As that shoulder injury built up, even though he was never a hard thrower, he would still get, you know, pretty consistently 88, 89, touch a 90 on his fastball and be able to throw his changeup at, you know, low 80s, upper 70s. He got to a point where his fastball really sat down more to like 85, 86, and there wasn't that much difference anymore. And that's when he started to get hit hard.
Yeah, I think, you know, you start to lose, right, some of that uniqueness. You know, the fastball was probably just hard enough to let the other stuff play off of it and just enough to keep hitters off timing. You dip much below that with how talented these guys are, you know, regardless of what the secondary stuff looks like. you know, it's hard to compete at that level. Like there's, you can't point to many guys over time that are thrown in the low to mid 80s and truly competing in the big leagues.
Yeah, it's so rare. Even like people will point back to Greg Maddux, but especially when Maddux was young, he was throwing 93, 94.
Yeah,
I love that. Time was pretty hard.
Yeah, I love the Maddux conversations. Like you go back and look at a video of Greg Maddux pitching, his stuff was ridiculous.
Yes.
But he just threw a ton of strikes too. So that it often gets lost in the equation with him. But you go back and pull a Greg Maddux video, the stuff was really, really good.
Yeah. It's amazing. The best pitcher in baseball had great stuff, right?
Yeah, so shocking.
Thanks for coming on. I'm going to have more questions for you in the future, but I mean, these are the topics I wanted to hit. I wanted to keep it to about 30 minutes. Anything else you want to bring up we didn't hit on?
No, glad we finally made it happen. I know it's been a few years in the making. Sad we didn't talk about the boys at all, but we can maybe save that for a later episode.
Now, at some point, some of the kids you're coaching, as they start to commit, we'll have to talk about those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. We should have a few more this summer when the period opens. So we'll be a fun summer. We have some kids that are making some really good strides right now. So it'll be an exciting summer for them and excited for their families.
So you're coaching at the Carolina Baseball Academy, right?
Yep, Charlotte Baseball Academy, based out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Yep, we have about 10 teams from all age groups, from 13U to 17U. I think we're going to get into a little bit more of the youth stuff in the years to come here, but it's a couple year old brand that I do with my father. He spearheads the whole thing, but I help him out when I can. I know I mentioned it earlier on the podcast, but I have a 9-to-5 job, unfortunately, that I'm tied to most of the time. But my true passion is coaching and helping kids, as you know, right? I do a lot of that on the side. So we'll hopefully be able to continue to do it.
Cool. Where can people find you?
I keep things pretty private. I'm not out there a ton, but all of my stuff is under at Matt Pirro, both on Twitter and Instagram.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it, Mike. Good talking to you.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us today. If you like this episode, please drop a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts and share an episode with a friend. Just a few seconds from you gives me great feedback and helps other Cub fans find the show. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, Blue Sky, and YouTube, all at Cubs PS+. And check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/CubsPSPlus to help support the show. As always, the theme music for this podcast is Prospect Park West by Jerry McCoy. This is Mike Waller, host of the Cubs PS Plus podcast. Every day with Cubs baseball or talking about Cubs baseball is a great day. Go Cubs!